All right, hi everybody. Welcome back. At the end of last week, I have this little device that I use to record the lectures, and usually I bring it home, and at the end of the day, I plug it in, and I upload it, and it takes about 15 minutes, and it works about 75% of the time, and often I have to do it again and again. And so last week, I actually had to go back to my office afterwards. I went back to my office, plugged it in, and uploaded it. It took like 6 seconds. I'm like, wow, fast network connections. That's kind of a useful thing. So,
you don't really care, I guess, but that turns out to be true. But yeah, network connections are cool. All right, so we'll get started on some clicker questions. We've got I've got a couple announcements to make, and we'll sort of keep cranking on chapter 4, which we'll be done with on Wednesday. So the plan is today I'm going to be talking about the halting problem and some related self-contradictory mathematical results. I forget what that leaves for Wednesday. And then next Monday will be a review, and the Wednesday after that will be the midterm. So just 3 seconds ago, I sent everyone an email. Some fraction of you may have even received it, given that you've got your computers open, with an announcement that homework 3 is out due Monday. I think I was supposed to give that out last week. I'm not sure. But anyway, it has stuff on it that we haven't quite covered yet, so it didn't seem like it made sense to get it out any earlier than this. But I also sent out a link to a practice midterm, so I've got 10 questions on it. Two of them are a new type that I didn't try last year, so I'm interested to see how that all turns out. But once again, the plan is you have this midterm. I suggest you go through it, try to answer things as best you can. Come next Monday with detailed questions. And what we'll do is we'll go over all the questions that you, all the problems on the sample midterm that you're having problems with. I'll go over carefully and show you how I would solve them, and you can take notes and so forth, and you can bring all that Wednesday for the midterm. The midterm will have exactly the same form as the sample midterm, the same 10 question types in the same order, but different details about exactly what you need to be doing. So again, if it's binary addition, I'll give you different binary numbers to add on the actual midterm as I did on the sample, but they'll be the same length and they'll have roughly the same number of ones. It'll be very similar. Yes?
We're going to be able to go over a certain question in the packet in the review session, right?
I won't go over any questions that will actually appear on the midterm, but I'll do any of the ones from the sample midterm or any variants of those.
That's what I was saying.
Yes.
So we don't have the right answers.
That would be the plan. So, and the best way for you guys to do that is take a look at the sample midterm that I sent out, try your hand at it, see if you really get it. If you get it, then you're in good shape. And if you don't get it, then you should ask and we'll make sure you're in good shape. So it shouldn't. None of them should be like way over your head, but they may require some clarification, some practice, and some hints. So I'm happy to give all those. We can do them before. Like if you have any questions now, I can answer them. But Monday is set aside for this and nothing but this. So you should have ample opportunity to be able to go over that with me. Okay, we good? And maybe I'll schedule a office hour too. All right, so that was two things. Oh, and last class I forgot to do the Google search, so I should do that. Here's an example number. Google did not find the word that we put up on the web. I think it's because it doesn't love me, but I don't know. All right. Oh, the other thing is, last time we were talking about examples of self-contradiction, the idea that a statement can actually refer to its own opposite, and we talked about oxymorons and a couple other sort of jokey things that have that same format. So just so happens that a friend of mine sent me this picture. A couple days ago, which is a sign on a door that says, "This door opens outwards. Please do not stand directly in front of the doors." And then that same message is repeated in Braille underneath for those who can't, read the sign. Now, what's the problem here? The problem is that though you can read the sign from across the room and not, know not to stand there, if you have to use Braille, you're right up against the door reading, where you're standing right now, you're in mortal danger. Right? It's like, maybe they should have put that off to the side or something, or a little bell, buzzer, warning buzzer, I'm not sure. But that somehow this sign is broken because it sort of contradicts itself. All right. Okay, so this is a couple quicker questions just to make sure that we're following along some of the things that we talked about. Let me do this. Sorry, I need a clicker. All right, the question is, hypothetically, I've decided that I really want to win a raffle. Each day, I enter a raffle that I have a 1 in 100 chance of winning. On average, how many days must I play before I win? Could be that I win on the very first try, but if I average together the number of steps that it takes before I win, what will that number be? Probability rule we've talked about a couple times now that says that if probability P is the probability that an event will occur, the number of times you have to repeat that trial before the event actually occurs on average is 1 over P. So if the probability is 1 out of 100, the number of repetitions on average is going to be 1 over 1 over 100, which is to say 100. All right. Similar question, slightly different form. I've got 100 folders on my desk. One of them has my train ticket in it. Each day I pick up a random one, check if it has the train ticket, and then put it aside. I think put it aside in this case means that I take it off of my desk, so it's no longer on my desk to be opened up a second time. How many days until I find the ticket on average? A little bit different than the previous one. The question is, does that difference actually change anything? Equations for this one before, but it's worth knowing. I think this is what I would like to do. I think what I would like to do is create a scratch program that will compare these two different cases. Can I do this? Let's see how that works. Well, let's see what people said first. So there's a small preference for D, but C is much stronger than it was in the previous one. So C was 50. Oh, I didn't read the choices, Brian, because that's problematic, right? Okay. But then I need to show you I think it's the same. I think these two slides have the same set of choices. A, 1 over 100, B, 4 thirds, C, 50, D, 100, E, 200.
Yeah, so same choices on this page. A, 1 over 100, B, 4 thirds, C, 50, D, 100, E, 200. So the other choice that, people said a lot of is 50, which is half of 100. And why would that be relevant? So imagine I've got all the things that I'm looking through lined up in front of me. So there's, say there's 20 things that I've got lined up, and I'm looking for one of them. So one particular one. So I pick up the first one, and if it's the right thing, okay, great. That's what I was looking for, I'm done. If not, I set it aside, and now there's only 19 things left. So the probability that I get it on the first shot is 1 over 20, but the probability I get it on the second shot is 1 over 19. It's changed. Okay, now I check the second one, and I either get it or I don't. Now, what's the chance that it'll take me all 20 tries to find what I'm looking for? Well, 1 out of 20. I check the first one, the second one, the third one, the fourth one, but the real thing I was looking for was in the 20th position, which is probability 1 over 20. I'll go through all 20 of them. But never more than that. I'll never go any more than 20. So I'll either do 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 up to 20, all with equal probability. So the average in this case is going to be half of 20, so 10. Or in this case, since there was 100 things that we're choosing from, as we exclude things from the list, it's getting the probability is going up and up and up, but we have to go through about half the list on average. So 50 is the answer that we're looking for. All right. If, on the other hand, so this is the difference between sampling with replacement and sampling without replacement. Sampling with replacement says, I look to see if I've got the right thing, and if it's not, I put it back in the pile, and I might get the same stupid thing over and over again. Right? So that's true of coin flips. If I flip ahead, if I'm trying to flip ahead, and I flip it, and it comes up tails, then the next time I flip, tails could come up again. I haven't excluded it from the set. The other kind of sampling is sampling without replacement, which says once you've gotten a bad answer, it leaves the pile and you'll never check it again. In that case, if you're trying to flip a coin and you want tails to come up, no, if you want heads to come up, and the first time you flip tails gets used up and you'll never see it again. Right? That would be a very different kind of problem. And on average, it would take you 1.5 flips, I guess, to get a head. All right, so I could write a little scratch program so we can try this out and compare them. I think I'm gonna set that aside for the moment, since we're in the middle of some other stuff. But if we've got a little time at the end, I think we might try that, just so you can sort of see that they actually come out quite different, or different by a factor of two, anyway. All right, so another question? This last one? Yeah, this last one in this set. So. We talked about generating random bits, a random 0 or a 1. So here's a little example from scratch where I'm using that idea. This pick random 0 to 1 is a little block that when you execute it, it either turns into a 0 or a 1. And what I've got here is I take the answer to that, multiply it by 4, take the answer to that and add 7, and take that whole answer and store it in A, set A to that value. So now, the question is, what values can A take if I execute this little piece of code? Does A take on either 0 or 1? Does it take on 0, 1, 4, or 7? Does it take on 4 or 7? Choice C. Choice D is, does it take on value 7 or 11? And choice E is, does it take on value 0 or 11? So, because there's a little bit of randomness in it, it will not necessarily always set A to the same value. But what values can it actually set A to? Does anyone have any trouble reading the? Is it a little fuzzy? Is it okay? I'm going to type it again. That's roughly what it says. Set A to this. Random 0 to 1, multiply by 4. So in a lot of computer languages, because X is the letter X, for multiplication, they use a star, like an asterisk. So if I write asterisk, I mean multiplication. All right. About 5 more seconds. Can we do that? The count, we're expecting a count up to about 53 or so. So a couple of you are holding out. All right. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Click it. Or not. Oh, there. Oh. As I was hitting the stop button. All right. You can live with that. Oh. Very good. All right, so let's see what happens here. So this random 0 to 1 is either a 0 or a 1. So let's just consider those two cases separately. If it's a 0, then this is going to be 0 times 4, which is 0, plus another 7, which is 7. So one thing that could come out of all this is A gets set to 7. What else could happen? Well, if this random coin flip comes out as a 1, then we've got 1 times 4, which is 4, plus another 7, 7 plus 4 is 11, so we get either 7 or 11. This was like the store. It was going to be sort of a joke, like the store. All right. Right, that still is a store, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Good. All right, so this is the 7-11 picker. All right, any questions about that? Comments? Ready to... We'll get back into chapter 4. All right. So I'm going to tell you a couple things that you will find difficult to believe, or some of you will find difficult to believe, and some of you may even get frustrated with me, for which I apologize in advance. But I will do the absolute best that I can to make this as convincing as I can. So we'll start off with what's known as Russell's Paradox. So the way that this is often told is there's some town, we'll call it Chelm, because then I get to use the ch sound. Because if you're going to learn to do it and you never get to use it in your language, you want to throw it in whenever you can. All right, so in the town of Chelm, there's a barber. His job is to shave every man in town who does not shave himself. Okay, so this is how we're defining who the barber shaves. Anyone in town who does not shave himself. Who shaves the barber? All right, so before we get into the mathematical aspect of this, some people may have heard this or maybe are thinking laterally and have answers to this puzzle that kind of undercut the mathematics but are very clever. Does anybody have a sort of a clever solution to this? Who shaves the barber?
His mom.
So there's the one that says, well, if the bar... Well, that doesn't quite work, right? His mom doesn't quite work because, well, first of all, she doesn't have very good manual dexterity. But second of all, because it says the barber shaves everyone who does not shave himself. So if it was his mom, then he would not be shaving himself, but the barber shaves everyone who doesn't shave himself, so he would have to shave himself. But wait, if he shaves himself, then he's not allowed to shave himself because he shaves everyone who doesn't shave himself, and only those people. So that's kind of messed up. So it can't be the mom. There's another way that people will look at this sometimes and say that the barber, well, if I had worded it differently, I have his job and shave, his job is to shave every man in town. There's one answer. If you phrase the question differently, you could say, ah, the barber's a woman. So she doesn't actually have to shave her own face. So she didn't, you know, anyway. But the point is that this, forgetting all those kind of backdoor kind of answers, here what we're supposed to be saying is the idea that there's something really broken here, right? As soon as we say that this barber shaves everyone who does not shave himself, we've created a contradiction. He simultaneously has to shave himself and cannot shave himself. So something is messed up. Now, Russell, not Stuart Russell, that's an AI guy. Do you remember Russell's first name? Anyway, real famous mathematician who I apologize for having forgotten, but he's dead, so he won't be too angry. But anyway, when he came up with this, he wasn't thinking about barbers. This was not some kind of a cosmetology or whatever the word is, kind of situation where he was really trying to understand interesting things about barbers. He was actually thinking about the underpinnings of mathematics. And people at that time were trying to create a formal definition of all of mathematics that was just like, you know, perfect and self-consistent and everything was going to be happy and fun and pleasant. And this was problematic because the kind of mathematics that people had at that time, which is now known as naive set theory. Presumably, they didn't call it naive set theory at the time, right? Like, hey, this is our set theory that we know is really, you know, incompletely thought out. Like, no, the set theory that they were using at the time, which is now known as naive set theory, was to say that you could define sets any way you wanted. And if you wanted to define a set of all people, well, all sets that do not contain themselves, you get exactly the Barber paradox, right? So imagine X is a set, and it's defined to be the set of all sets that do not contain themselves. Well, is X in the set X or not? If it is, then it can't be. And if it's not, then it has to be. So something is busted. And so what the, the conclusion here was, what's busted is you're not allowed to define sets any way you want. You're not allowed to have unrestricted self-reference. Because if you do, you can use that to create impossible situations. Because you can refer, a set can refer to itself and at the same time negate its own existence. So they had to be much more careful about how they defined sets and what sort of things were allowed to be defined by them. So that was, it ended up being a very important thing. It changed the way that people had formalized mathematics up to that time, all because of this sort of annoying self-contradiction. All right, here's another one that also very much changed the way people think about mathematics. So Kurt Gödel was, brilliant mathematician slash crazy person who was in New Jersey. Here's a picture of Gödel on the left. He looks a little bit like one of the scary guys from Raiders of the Lost Ark, but... pretty sure that wasn't him. He's hanging around with Einstein. They were apparently good buddies. And Einstein, who was not the most organized person in the world, was so much better at like taking care of himself that he used to also help take care of Gödel, because Gödel wasn't very good at that. This is why I hear. But they're in New Jersey when this picture was taken. Because, you know, that's where a lot of good things happen. So what Gödel showed, and this is just so twisted and brilliant, he was able to create a mathematical statement using just standard mathematics that could be interpreted as follows. This statement itself cannot be proven. Okay? So he made a mathematical statement that said, by referring to itself, I cannot be proven. Now, what's the problem with that? Now, the way he did that is all very, very clever, and we don't have time to get into the details of it, but it has to do with the fact that you can work with infinitely large sets of numbers in mathematics, and the numbers can be interpreted as logical implications, but that's not what's important. What's important is he made this statement. And what does this statement show? It shows that, let's look at it. If the statement is true, this statement cannot be proven, then mathematics, there are things in mathematics that you can state that are true but cannot be proven using mathematics. You can't make a proof that it's true. You just have to take it on faith or something. It's like you can't actually show within mathematics that the statement's true. That's if it's true. What if it's false? If it's false, this statement cannot be proven. That means that the statement can be proven, but it's a false statement. So that means that you've got a proof of a false statement, which means that mathematics itself is inconsistent. You can prove things that are wrong. So this is kind of a very unfortunate choice. Basically, what Gödel said is, you can have your mathematics in two flavors. One flavor can't do everything, and the other flavor is wrong. But is there not a third choice? No. What he showed is that there is not a, it's complete and correct. That is no longer an option. So that's very clever. And again, the way that he did this is by making a statement that can refer to itself. I cannot be proven, is what it says. So that's very, very clever. And up to that time, there were people that were trying to write mathematics books that showed that, wouldn't it be great if we actually had a book that had all the true statements in it, in mathematics? Everything. And then we're done. We don't have to do any more mathematics, because anything we want to know, we just look it up in the book. And what Gödel said is, the book, there cannot be such a book, because there are things that are true that you can't prove, so you wouldn't be able to have a proof for them in the book, so you're stuck, you're screwed. So okay, that's kind of interesting. Here's another one. This one you maybe relate to a little bit better. Cantor talked about comparing the size of infinite sets. So we know that if I say, you know, what about the set of numbers from 1 to 10, and how does that compare to the set of numbers from 11 to 20, set of integers, right? So they're both the same size, right? They both have 10 things in them. How do you know that? Well, you can put the numbers in one-to-one correspondence. Like the 1 is like the 11, the 2 is like the 12, the 3 is like the 13. And all the numbers can be paired up so that nobody is missing a pair. If you define the size of a set to be that property. Two sets are the same size if you can put all their members, you can pair them up, you can put them in one-to-one correspondence, then the sets have to be the same size. So that makes perfect sense when you're talking about finite sets. But Cantor said, well, you can use that same idea for infinite sets. You can say two infinite sets are the same size if you can put all their elements in one-to-one correspondence with each other. Now, it's an infinitely long list of correspondences, but that's okay, because no matter what element you choose from the one side, it has a partner on the right side. And whatever you choose on the right side, it has a partner on the left side. Nobody's got two partners. They must be the same size. So let's use this idea for a second. According to Cantor's definition of the size of sets, what is there more of? Is there more even numbers or odd numbers? Or are they the same? They're the same. Okay, why? Because we can pair them up. So let's just do that to make it concrete. Okay, that's scary. Limits and square roots. Oh my. All right, so if we start writing a list of all the, what did I say, the odd numbers and the even numbers. Let's write the odds. 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, 13. Tell me when to stop. Actually, it goes on forever. Don't worry about that. What about the evens? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14. Da, 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 da. All right. So these are the odds. And these are the evens. And I say they're the same size sets if we can make a one-to-one correspondence. You give me an odd number, and I'll tell you its partner in the even list. You give me an even number, and I'll tell you its partner in the odd list. So how can we, now I only listed a couple of them. Can we do this for all the odds and all the evens? So what would be the rule that would match an odd number? Let's say we have an odd number x. Well, I'll write it down here. An odd number x gets matched to what even number? We need a rule that can apply to all of them. I only listed a finite number. X always gets matched to x plus 1. If this is an odd number, is this an even number?
Yes.
Yeah, right? Because, again, we're talking about the integers here. If this is an odd number, it means there's one left over if you divide it by 2. Well, if we just stick one more onto the pile, then it'll be even. Right? It'll be divisible by 2. What about the other direction? If we have an even number y, who does that get partnered with on the odd side?
Y minus
1. So the number right before it in the list. And again, if this is an even number, y minus I has to be an odd number. So that works out great. All right, so, and that sort of feels right too, right? There's about the same number of even numbers as odd numbers. You're kind of skipping through the list. They both skip more or less the same. All right. So here's the next question. What is there more of? Integers, that is to say numbers from, well, we'll do the natural numbers. So 1 to infinity, and even numbers. So 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, like that. So intuitively, it seems like there's fewer even numbers, right? Because every even number actually appears on the list of all counting numbers, plus there's a bunch of other stuff there. So it seems like there's more counting numbers than even numbers. But not according to Cantor. Because Cantor said, well, if you can put them in one-to-one correspondence, they're the same size. They're both the same kind of infinity. So how can we do that? Could we show that the even numbers and all the counting numbers are in one-to-one correspondence? So we have the counting numbers like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And we've got the evens like 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, and they go on like that. How can we map them up? So again, if these are the counting numbers are x, and the even numbers are y, which even number can we pair up each counting number with? X can be paired up with what even number? So x can get matched to, well, in this case, oops, that's kind of your game. 2x. And we can easily go the other way too, which is to say, if you give me an even number y, I can connect it up with y over 2, right? I can divide it in half. For every even number, it has a partner. It has exactly one partner. And every counting number has an even number partner, exactly one partner. They're the same size sets. So is that a question?
Yeah. Isn't anything that counts to infinity even with anything else that counts to infinity?
Right. So that's what Cantor's going to show is that there is at least one other kind of infinity. So we'll get to that in a second. But yes, it sure seems that way. But the only way you can actually prove that is if you come up with a rule that matches one to the other. So let's do a slightly harder one just to show that it's not quite so obvious. So the integers are all the numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, all the way to infinity, and the negations of those two. So it goes in both directions. So 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and negative 1, negative 2, negative 3, negative 4, negative, okay? So that it extends infinitely in both directions. So let's compare, that's the integers. And then we've got the positive integers, or we'll call it the counting numbers again, the natural numbers, counting numbers. So the integers goes dot, 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 negative 5, negative 4, negative 3, negative 2, negative 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, dot, dot, dot. It's got dot, dot, dots in both directions. And the counting numbers are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, dot, dot, dot. Only dot, dot, dot's in one direction. So again, it sort of seems like there's more integers because every one of the counting numbers is already on this list. In fact, it seems like there's sort of twice as many over here because there are all the negations as well. But, what's your name?
Julie
hypothesized, she conjectured, that all infinite sets are the same size. And if that's true, there ought to be some way of mapping each of the integers to exactly one counting number, each of the counting numbers to exactly one integer. They should go back and forth like that. If they're the same size, there has to be a one-to-one correspondence. How can we do that? How can we make a list of all the integers so that they're all on the list and each one matches a counting number? Any thoughts on that? Well, one thing that would help is if we somehow got rid of the dot, dot, dot on both directions in the integers, right? So these guys, we can at least list them, right? We can list them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and so on, okay? But these guys, can we even make a list that has all of the integers in it? If we start at 0 and start counting up, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, dot, 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 we'll skip all the negatives. We somehow need a list that has all of them in it. So how can we systematically list all of the integers? How can we do that? Yes?
Well, could you do an if statement?
To do what? What would that accomplish?
So like if let's say integers is x and counting numbers is y.
Uh-huh.
Could you say that if x is negative, multiply x by -1.
-1, okay.
If x negate is positive, then multiply it by 1, or yeah, just by 1.
All right, so then that would you'd say we can make each of the integers have a partner in the counting numbers by taking its absolute value, right? If it's negative, just flip it around and make it positive. If it's positive, leave it as it is. So that would give every one of these guys a partner. Unfortunately, then these guys would have two partners, right? So 7 would be mapped to both positive 7 and negative 7. And we have to make sure that it goes exactly 1-to-1, that every integer has one partner on the right and every counting number has one partner on the left. That doesn't quite work. So we need some way of actually, you know, figuring, well, so who's going to match 1? 1 would be a good answer to that, I guess. But then who's for 2? Well, 2 could be that. Yeah, we're going to end up leaving out all the negatives if we're not careful. So we have to be a bit more careful. I like the way you're thinking about that. The if statement is going to be really key. Well, think of it this way. We can make two lists, right? Two infinitely long lists. One that goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, dot, dot, dot. And the other one that goes 0, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, minus 4, dot, dot, dot. These two lists will include every one of the integers. But we need to somehow merge them to make one list. So how would you do that? If I asked you to read this infinite list, one element at a time, so that you could guarantee that you'd never skip any of them, how would you do that? So you can't just read the whole right-hand side until it's done, because it'll never be done, then switch to the left. You're going to have to somehow... Yes?
A plus or a minus
next to every one.
Like plus or minus
1,
plus or minus
2. Yes, yeah, I know that. So this kind of symbol. Plus or minus thing. But then that's not really a number anymore. Now it's a pair of numbers. Oh, I see. But what you're saying is we could list 0, plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, plus or minus 3. And then in some sense, they're all in there. Okay, almost there. But the thing is, we can't list plus or minus as a number. So we have to somehow make sure that both of them are included. We can take the list, we can spread out the list a little bit. Well, what if you had to actually read that list to me? So let me write your list. Your list goes something like this. 0, plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, plus or minus 3, plus or minus 4, and so on. But if I said, read this list to me, but only say one number at a time, what would you do? You'd say, uh-huh. No, but you can only do one number at a time. You can say 0, 1, negative 1, 2, negative 2, 3, negatives. We just took the two lists and we interleaved them, right? So even though they're both infinite, every element from the one list is going to show up in the merged list. Every element from the other list is going to show up in the merged list. It may be twice as deep in the list than it was, but that's okay. Infinity is plenty big for everybody. So here's what I'm going to suggest. What if we do that? Use that ordering over here. We say 1 will map to 0, 2 will map to 1, 3 will map to minus 1, 2 will map to 4, so I'm sorry, I'm reversing. Negative 2 matches to 5, 3 matches to 6, negative 3 matches to 7, 4 matches to 8, negative 4 matches to 9, 5 matches to 10, and so on. So now, can we use your if idea now to figure out what exactly is this pair? I'd like to say that we all believe that all the counting numbers will be on the right, and all the integers will be on the left. Right? Every number is going to show up eventually. Now, what's the rule for matching them to each other? If this is x, what does that match to? If you can't read my handwriting, it may actually be harder. I apologize for that. I can read down that again. Yeah.
If x is a positive number, and then that matches to an even number.
Then it matches to what?
An even number?
Yeah, but what even number?
2x,
right? So 3 matches to 6, 4 matches to 8. So 2x matches with 2x if it's positive.
What about for 0?
What if it's... I wrote if it's greater than 0. So we still have to handle 0. But you have the if x is greater than 0, but what do you have anything for the negatives?
If it's negative...
If x is less than 0, then, so we have like minus 4. If we double minus 4, that would be minus 8. Go ahead.
It's the positive 2x.
Right, so negate x.
Plus
1.
Times 2.
Times 2. Good. So minus 2x. Minus 2x plus 1. So let's see, does that actually work? So negative 1. Times negative 2 is 2, plus 1 is 3. That would work. Negative 2 times negative 2 is 4, plus 1 is 5. Good. Negative 3 times negative 2 is 6, plus 1 is 7. Good. And so on. The times 2 here is serving the purpose of opening up the list so that there's other space for the other things. So that's great. What about 0? Does 0 fit either of these rules, or do we need a special case? 0 fits the second one. So if x is less than or equal to 0, take the number, multiply it by minus 2 and add 1. So if it's 0, it's minus 2 times 0, which is 0, plus 1 is 1. We've got the first thing on the list. So they're the same size. We had to do something cute, right? We had to actually spread out the list and make room for the negatives, but that's okay, we handled that. Just took a little thinking. Alright? And you can do more and more crazy things to get this to work out. So, alright, so that was a bit of a diversion. Let's see if we can connect it back up to what we're talking about. So now what we're going to do is we're going to compare fractions and decimals. The decimals in this case, I don't mean base 10, I mean like 0.3692, those kind of decimals. 0.3 repeating decimals. We know there's an infinite number of both of those. In fact, even if we're just focused, well, yeah, so there's an infinite number of both of those. Are they the same size infinity? Well, we can make an infinitely long list that includes every fraction. So let's take a look at that, because this is slightly weird. It's a little weirder than our positive and negative one, but it's the same kind of idea. So, you know, here's a bunch of fractions. 2/3, 2/6, 3/7, 101 divided by 217, right? There's lots of these things. But we can make a list that has all of them in it by listing them carefully. First, 0 over 1, then 0 over 2, 1 over 1. So those are all the numbers. So the 0 over 1 is all the fractions that lie between 0 and 1. We're only going to do it between 0 and 1. That lie between 0 and 1, where the numerator and the denominator add up to 1. There's only one of them. But now we're going to list all the ones, next part of the list, all the fractions where the numerator and denominator add up to 2. 0 over 2, 1 over 1. Now we'll list all the fractions where the numerator and the denominator add up to 3. 0 over 3, 1 over 2. Is that it? Yeah, I guess so. Now we list all the ones where the numerator and the denominator add up to 4. 0 over 4, 1 over 3, 2 over 2. Next. So we're going to just keep repeating this so that we list all of the fractions, which is easy to do because we just increment the numerator on each one. List them all out where they add up to each constant, one constant after the other. So if we've got a fraction like 101 over 217, which we know has to be on the list someplace, 1 over 1 over 217, the sum of these, the numerator and denominator, is 318. Deep down in the list will be a sublist of all the fractions where the numerator and the denominator add up to 318. It'll be on the list eventually. Every fraction will show up on this list. Okay? Does that make sense? Can you think of any fractions that wouldn't be on the list, or can you think of another way to do the same thing? We have to be a little bit careful. We can't put them in sorted order, right? Because let's say we wanted to go the first 0, then the smallest fraction that's bigger than 0. There is no smallest fraction bigger than 0, right? For any fraction you give me, I can multiply the denominator by 2 and give you a fraction that's smaller. So we can't just list them in numerical order. That wouldn't work. But this does work, okay? Where we list them in where the numerator and the denominator add up to a constant. Just keep increasing the constant. All the fractions will end up being on this list. In fact, I think if I gave you a complicated enough rule, you give me a fraction, I could tell you exactly what position it would be on the list. I could put these numbers in one-to-one correspondence with the counting numbers. Okay? So what do we know? We know that the set of fractions between 0 and 1 is the same size as the set of integers, the set of even numbers, the set of odd numbers, the set of counting numbers. They're all the same infinity. But what about the decimals? Can we make a list that has every single decimal number in it? So we can't do this add to a constant trick anymore, because we're going to have some decimals like 0.3 repeating, where the sum of the digits is infinity. So that doesn't really work. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to use self-reference, self-contradiction in fact, to show that you cannot list all the decimals, and therefore that there must be more of them than there are fractions. So here's how we're going to do it. This is called a proof by contradiction. We're going to pretend for a moment that you can list them all, and then show that that list has to leave off at least one of the decimals. So here's how it goes. So here's a hypothetical list. I've made a list of all the decimals in some crazy order. 0.5795391657012365 And then the next one, 0.988767. Okay, anyway. So you can imagine these are decimals between 0 and 1. There's a bunch of them on the list, and now we're going to say, could we possibly have listed out all of them? So here's what we're going to do. We're going to build a decimal number that can't be on the list, given the list. So here's how it goes. We're going to read down the diagonal. Okay?
There's a 5 in the first. The first decimal has a 5, one position after the decimal point. The second number has an 8, two positions after the decimal point. The third number has a 9, three positions after the decimal point, and so on down the list. Okay. So what does that mean? That means that So every number on the list will eventually show up. The diagonal will actually include every single number in the list, going deeper and deeper down in the list. We're going deeper and deeper into the decimals. All right. So we're going to read down that and pretend that's actually a number. Okay. So 0.58980324467, perfectly reasonable decimal. All right. Then what we're going to do is we're going to add 1 to all those positions. So we get another decimal. In this case, 0.69091435578. Right, we're just adding 1 to each of the each of those numbers, but we wrap around, so a 9 turns into a 0. So we're just changing each of those positions. All right, so that decimal, 0.69091435578. Okay, we've just built another decimal number, and I'm gonna claim that that number that we just made can't be on the list. And therefore, you left off at least, whoever it is that made the list had to have left off at least 1. Why is this number not on the list? Well, can it be in the first position? No, because it's the first digit, the 6, is different from the first digit of the first number. Well, could it be in the second position on the list? No, because the second decimal, the 9, the second digit after the decimal point, is a 9, which is different from the second position of the second element on the list, which is an 8. I don't know. What about the 100th position? There's a digit in the 100th down from the decimal point place. Whatever number is in that number can't be anywhere on this list. It has to be different from the 100th element on the list because, the way we constructed it. Okay. So this number, it can't be anywhere in the list because it's different from every number in the list in at least one position. So there must be more decimals between 0 and 1 than there are fractions between 0 and 1. Yes?
Why can't we just add that to the list and say it's in the list now?
So where do we add it exactly? At the bottom? Well, there is no bottom, right? Because it's an infinitely long list. So we could sort of be walking down the list waiting to put it in and never get there. We could make a little space for it, right? So we could shift everybody down and stick this in the first position, say. That's a perfectly reasonable place to put it. But now we say, okay, you've made a new list. I can give you a number that's not on that list either. All right, specifically by doing the same diagonalization trick.
Isn't that like the definition of infinity?
The definition of?
Infinity.
Yeah. The definition of infinity is what? That you can't...
You keep finding something that's on the list, and then you keep it on the list.
You can keep adding it to the list. Yeah, it's a reasonable thing to say. I don't have an argument against that right away. So you're saying here's a process that we could use to create a list with everything on it. We just keep adding one more thing into the list, take the list that we've got so far and add another element to it. And this process will never complete. But you're saying that's okay because it's an infinitely long list anyway, so we can have an infinitely long process to generate it. I'll have to think about that some. Yeah, I often will get some kind of pushback on this claim. And often it's because it's a little hard to understand all the steps and people don't get all the steps quite right. But that actually that's a valid interpretation of the steps as I describe them. That requires a bit more thought. But this result has actually stood up for more than 100 years. So I'm pretty sure that we won't find a hole in it. But the cool thing about math is you never can tell. Somebody has to look at things just a little bit differently. All right. So again, but the reason that I included this example is not because this class is about how big is a set of all integers or whatnot. It's because the trick here for showing that there's more decimals than fractions is this idea of self-contradiction. You take the list, you find something that you build something that's not on the list by making the list kind of break itself. In this case, by reading a number that shares a digit with all the numbers in the list and then changing it so that it doesn't anymore. So it negates the fact that it can't be on the list. It negates the fact that it could be on the list. All right. So
So this is leading us up to an issue of computability. What are the things that we can actually compute with computers, and are there things that we can't compute? So Cantor's proof basically says there are things that you can't list. You can't list all the decimals. But are there problems that you can't actually compute with a computer program? So I'm going to take you through how the answer is yes, and I'll take you through how this is argued. So here's three different Scratch scripts that all do the same thing. Each of the scripts counts I backwards from 10 to 1 and pops each time, makes a popping sound. Okay, so let's look at these one at a time. So the top one starts off and sets I to 10, and then it has a repeat loop. It says repeat until I equals 0, pop, and change I by minus 1. So I starts off at 10, it pops, goes to 9, goes around the loop again, pops, goes to 8, pops, goes to 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, pops at 1, then gets decreased to 0, goes back up to the top of the repeat loop, and now I equals 0, so the loop terminates. Okay? So this will actually stop when I reaches 0. It'll do 10 pops and be done. Here's another way of writing the same thing that's a little bit more direct. The second script says we start off setting I to 10, then we repeat I times. Well, so it's going to repeat 10 times. Each of those 10 times, it will pop, and then I will be decreased to 1 smaller than it was. So again, pop, and then it goes down to 9, pop, and then it goes down to 8, pop, it goes down to 7. So it really more or less does the same thing. It does it in a different way, though, and it's important to understand how. All right, here's another one. this one starts off setting the bottom script, the third script, sets I to 10, and then it does a forever loop. Okay, so forever loop says, do this forever. What are we going to do? Well, if I is less than 1, it stops the script. So it won't actually run forever. If I ever gets less than 1, that will cause it to stop. But if I is not less than 1, it pops and decreases I by 1. So again, it's going to do the same thing. If I is 10, it's going to pop and get decreased to 9. Pop and get decreased to 8. Eventually, it's going to get down to 1. It will pop, get decreased down to 0, go back up to the top of the forever loop. I will now be less than 1, so the script will stop. Okay. One cute thing to notice in Scratch is that the stop script block doesn't have a little notch at the bottom, so you can't clip anything underneath of it, which kind of makes sense. Like, once the script is supposed to stop, you can't reach any of the statements underneath of it. All right, so these three scripts do the same thing. They count down from 10 to 1, popping each time. But now I'm going to change the question a little bit. What if, is there any other number that we could stick in instead of the 10 in any of these scripts that would cause the script to run forever? So,
does it have to be just changing the 10?
Yes, yeah, we can change if we took out the if statement in the forever loop, it would run forever. The question is, can we change just the value that we set I to initially so that the loop will just keep running forever? Yeah, is that, before, hold that thought. Let me, I think I can actually bring this up in Scratch. Oh, that looks more or less like what we got, right? If we put this at 10. This is not quite what we had. That's what we had. Right? So here's a script. Set I to 10, repeat until I equals 1. Set I to 10. Oh, it's not I, but it's X. Is that okay? Everyone all right? I is now played. Today, substituting for I, the role of I will be played by X. All right, 10 pops. Okay. So this script doesn't pop forever. It pops 10 times, and then it stops. Is there any number that we could stick in here that would cause it to run forever? What if we put in something like 20? It went 20 times and stopped. So it sort of seems like whatever number we put in here, it will pop that number of times.
Is it possible to put a negative number in there?
It's possible.
Because then it'll pop forever because it'll never equal 0.
So we'll put in 0 first. What if we put in 0? All right, so we set x to 0. It says repeat until x equals 0, which it does right away, so nothing happens. But what if we put in minus 1? All right, so each time it's going through, it's decreasing x by 1. If you look at the current value of x, when is this going to hit 0?
Never.
Never. When is this going to stop?
Never.
Never? Well, it's sort of never. We're going to actually just see if we can make it stop now, because otherwise it will slowly go insane. Ah, so close. All right, so the answer to this question for each, is there an initial value we can set I to, or x, so that it would cause the script to loop forever? And the answer is, for the first one was yes, right? If we put any, so what are the values that we can stick in here? So anything 0, 1, 2, 3, they all stop. Anything that's less than 0, it's going to run forever. Is that everything? Is there any other numbers we could stick in here that would cause it to run forever? Oh, I don't know. What about 5? Will it run forever?
No. Any positive number.
What about 5.5? What happened? When did it hit 0? Why did it not hit 0? It skipped it, right. The test here says when x equals 0, well, what happened is at some point it got down to a half. It subtracted 1 from it, skipped right over 0, and went to minus a half. Now 0 is behind it, and now it's just, you know, keep shuffling off the buffalo, right? It's just gonna run forever. So in fact, the only numbers it will stop for are 0 and, well, the positive integers, the non-negative integers, 0, 1, 2, 3, those kinds of numbers. But not any fraction. Any fraction will cause it to miss the 0. And not any negative number. Any negative number, it's already missed 0. All right. So we, as you know, smart people, we can look at this and analyze it and say, okay, I know exactly what values we can stick in here that will cause it to either stop eventually or run forever. Those being the two basic choices. All right. What about the second script? The second script says, set I to 10, repeat I times, pop, and decrease I. So what will this do? Is there anything that we could plug in for this instead of 10 here that would cause this to run forever? I'll let you think about that for a moment while I see if I can find someplace where I've already written this. So this script here, is there anything that we could, is there anything that we could stick in here instead of the 10? Okay, that was 10 pops and it was done. If we put in 4, it pops 4 times. If we put in negative 10, it does nothing. Why? Because repeat checks to see if it's a negative number, and if it is, it doesn't run the loop. So we can't make it run forever by sticking in a negative in this case. What about a fraction? 5.5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I counted 6. So what did it seem like it did here? It did stop. How many times did it pop? 11. Where did it get 11 from? It must have rounded this up, right? So if we put in like 2.01, how many times do we expect it to go? Yeah. All right. So is there anything that we can plug in here that's going to cause this to run forever? 0? No. Negatives didn't seem to bother it. Fractions didn't seem to bother it. I think this guy's pretty robust. I don't think we can make this one run forever. Anyone disagree? All right, well, moving on to the last one. Here's the last script. Actually, we'll just hide this one. So this one says, it starts off sending x to a value, and then it does this for every loop. If I is less than 1, it stops. So it did 10 pops. We can do 2 pops. What if we put in a fraction? Will it run forever? No. How many times will it pop? Is it going to round up or round down, I guess is the question. Okay, see what it did? Look at the final value of I. It starts off at 2.5. It counts down, and once it goes below 1, it stops. So it ends up rounding down. If we put in 3.01, it should do it just 3 times. If we put in a negative number, what do we expect? Is it going to go forever? Is it going to go at all? Maybe just once? Do we hear 1? Anybody think 1? Okay, no, it just doesn't go at all. All right, so this guy also seems pretty robust. Any other thoughts here? I mean, what if we can put in, like, does that work? All right, who can tell me what just happened? This is kind of odd. Can you watch the I? Watch the value of I. It briefly becomes the word infinity. You see it? I mean, it could be anything, too. It could be like, you know, cookie. See? It briefly becomes cookie. So, is cookie less than 1? Apparently, it is. No, apparently it's not. Because it doesn't stop the script. But it pops once, and then it changes I by minus 1. So what's cookie minus 1? Apparently, it treats cookie as 0. Subtracts 1 from it, making it minus 1, and then the script stops. So that's odd. I mean, strange, not odd. But it doesn't run forever. And in fact, I don't think there's any way to make this script run forever. I think all numbers, it will stop eventually. Okay? Does that work? So of these 3 scripts that we had, the bottom 2 have the property that there's nothing that we can substitute in instead of the 10 to make it run forever. The top script, on the other hand, any fraction will cause it to screw up, run forever, and any negative number will cause it to screw up and run forever. Okay? So here's the general question that we're trying to analyze here. I have some questions like this on the midterm sample and the homework, which basically look at this, and is there any what numbers can you put in? In place of the question mark or in place of the 10 to make it run forever. Sometimes the answer is none. It is always going to stop. Sometimes it doesn't matter. It's always going to run forever. But this question of can you tell whether it will run forever, it turns out to be a really important and interesting thing. It's called the halting problem. And the reason that this is an important problem is because when you write a program that you want to actually compute something, give you the answer and stop, and instead it just runs forever, like without actually outputting anything, It's really irritating because you don't know whether it's just not done yet or if it's never ever going to be done. So if there was some kind of programming tool that could just, you know, analyze the program and say, oh, there's a problem here, this is never going to complete, that would be really useful because before you run the program, you could check it and see, oh, this is going to run forever, you're going to have to change it before you try it. So we would like a subroutine called halt tester that could actually take a program as input, actually give it a program. And what it'll do on the program is return true if the program halts on all inputs and false if there's some input that makes it loop forever. That would be a really useful subroutine. Here's the problem. If there was such a subroutine, we could make an impossible program, like the barber, like the list of all decimals. Like the, what was the other thing that we looked at? There was one other one. Oh, like, Gödel's theorem. So, if this existed, we could make something that was impossible. And here's the way we're going to do it. We're going to make a little subroutine, a little scratch script called contrary. Here's what contrary does. Good night. It takes a program, prog, as input. And the first thing it does, it says, hey, did you just give me as input?
If the answer is yes, it asks halt tester whether or not it halts. Okay? So it basically says, oh, you want someone wants to know whether or not I halt. I'll find out by calling halt tester. If halt tester comes out with an answer of yes, you halt, then contrary will go into an infinite loop, popping. Right? Forever, play sound pop until done. Otherwise, if halt tester says, no, there, you do go into an infinite loop for some inputs, then this will halt. And in fact, if any input that's not contrary, this will halt. So now the question is, what does this do? What does halt tester return for contrary? Well, the main issue is, what does contrary do when it's given itself as input? If halt tester answers 1, in other words, contrary halts on all inputs, that means it should halt even when it's given itself as input. But that's exactly the case where contrary halts, goes into an infinite loop. So it must be the case that halt tester returns 0, saying that there is some input for which this will go into an infinite loop. But in that case, note that contrary halts for all inputs, including itself. Okay? So this is a subroutine that, if it's told, it sort of does the opposite of what it's told, right? If it's told, hey, you halt on all inputs, then it's like, no, I don't. I'm going into an infinite loop, right? And just goes into an infinite loop. On the other hand, it says, hey, if it says, do I always go into an infinite loop? Halt on all inputs? And the other thing says, no, there's some things for which you go into an infinite loop. Then this guy goes, great, I quit. And it doesn't go into an infinite loop. So it does the opposite of whatever it's told. So that means that this can't happen. There's a problem here. This is a program that simultaneously has to halt for all inputs and not halt for all inputs. So something. What was the problem here? The problem was our assumption that you could solve the halting problem. Our assumption that halt tester could exist must be flawed. All right. If halt tester says contrary always halts, then it purposely loops forever. If halt tester says contrary sometimes doesn't halt, then it never loops no matter what it's given as input. Just like the Barber paradox, the problem here is the assumption that halt tester can exist. So halt tester is a well-defined problem that would be really useful to solve that no computer program can solve. It's an incomputable problem. Okay? There are some things that computers can't do. And this is one. It can't solve the halting problem for all inputs. All right, so any comments or questions on that? There's two things that I'd like you to get out of it. One is just the fact that there are problems that computer scientists would like to be able to solve with computers that cannot be solved. There can be no program that for all input programs decides whether or not it halts. And the reason it can't exist is because you could create a self-contradictory program if it could. Now, you can make a program that can tell sometimes if a program is going to halt or not, and that would still be kind of useful, but it can't solve it for all inputs, because if it could solve it for contrary, and that would cause a self-contradiction. So such a program can't exist. Now, you could have one that would say, would it halt after, an hour? How could you write a program that would test if another program will halt before an hour is up? Well, it could just run that program for an hour, and if it's still running at the end of the hour, it'll say, no, I guess it didn't halt in an hour. Right? So that's perfectly plausible, perfectly easy to do. What you can't do is know, is it going to eventually halt at some unbounded time in the future for all possible programs? That's just impossible. All right, so what I'd like to do is show you a song about that. This has been the least popular of my videos. The cool thing about putting things up on YouTube is it becomes very democratic. I don't know that it's a perfect democracy, but it's not clear that any democracy is a perfect democracy. But of all the songs that I put up for class, this is the one that has gotten the least number of hits. So I apologize in advance. And I think it's because the song itself has... The punchline is sort of a bad pun on a very abstract concept. So let me tell you that part in advance. So the setup here is that I'm going to build an analogy between the halting problem and a bar bet. Okay? And the bar bet is this guy says that he can tell for everybody in the bar what they're going to do when they drink tequila. And that turns out to be impossible because person could then ask them, what am I going to do? Am I going to drink tequila a certain way or not? And if that person said, oh, you will do it this way, the person could just then choose to do the opposite. Okay? Because you can ask about, I'm in the bar, you can ask about, I can ask about me, therefore you can't answer for all people in the bar because I could just be contrary. So I'm hoping that that kind of gets the basic idea across. So we'll see how this plays. Be a computer playing a piano. No, actually, at the moment, it should be playing a harmonica. So that's just already wrong. No? Maybe. Yeah, it's the least from the web.
It's hours past when I guess it is. So I'll make an attempt not to try.
There's a lot of self-contradiction.
Up to me with a grin and a gleam in
his
eye.
That's Diddles.
He says, choose anyone at the bar tonight, and I'll make you this bet just for fun. No, it's not the default. Some folks drink booze with salt, and I'll tell up. I picked me, so now you gotta stay.
deciding whether or not the halting problem or the salting problem is who's going to do it, whether a person will drink with the salt or not, which is like, will this program halt or on all inputs or not? And the piano player is playing the role of contrary, which basically the contrary was written to say, hey, do I halt? Do you think I'm going to halt? I'll do the opposite. So do you think I'm going to drink my tequila with salt? And I'll do the opposite. Therefore, you lose the bet. You can't actually solve the problem you claim to solve. So you can think about the halting problem as being kind of like a bar bit. Let's see, it's not, oh, yeah, so I said that already.
So that's the end of that?
There are some problems in computer science that actually can be mapped to the halting problem. So there's one that I worked on in my thesis, which was finding optimal policies for partially observable Markov decision processes, and I couldn't solve it for the long. I couldn't make a program that would always be able to answer the right, find the optimal policy in a POMDP. And I sort of guessed that it might be equivalent to the halting problem and therefore incomputable. And a couple years later, a student at the University of Washington went and actually proved it and found, in fact, yes, this is an incomputable problem. If you could solve the problem that Littman wanted to solve, then you could solve the halting problem. We know that's not possible. Therefore, Littman's problem is unsolvable as well. So I don't feel as bad for not actually being able to solve it. Some have argued that since people can tell if, I think we're now out of time. So next time I'll talk about, well, can people solve this problem? Programs can't, not for all programs. So what about people? So if you want to think about that some, that would be great. And we'll talk again on Wednesday. Yeah. I did announce at the beginning that homework 3 is released now. I sent an email about it. And there's also a sample midterm that's out now. So you want to take a look at that, and I'll have...